When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to The Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Tosh Robinson, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and Keith Phipps.
Scott Tobias is off busking in Europe, but we found someone else playing cello on the street and brought him in to fill Scott's chair in the orchestra. Podcaster, musician, culture writer, and fan of the show, David Chen, who last joined us for a pairing of Akira Kurosawa's Throne of Blood and Joel Coen's Macbeth. David has a lot of podcasts and a lot of ventures going on at any particular time, but his latest project, which we heartily recommend you check out and which we'll be pointing to some specific aspects of during this pairing, is Decoding Everything, a collection of cultural writing and interviews you can find at decodingeverything.com. Welcome back to the show, David.
It is an absolute thrill to be back. Thank you for the invitation.
Much though you seemed concerned that all of our podcast listeners would run away in terror at your last pairing. It in fact pushed us over the edge. We were taken to the downtown Chicago and given the key to the city. They said that this is what we've been waiting for all along, which is makes
Incredible.
It odd that we've waited so long to invite you back, David.
Yeah, a lot of mysteries.
Well, this one's really up your alley. You've already written about one of these movies, and we're going to see what you think about the other one. This week, we're going to be discussing two romantic films where, if you look at it a certain way, absolutely nothing happens. Everybody has big feelings, but nobody takes big actions, at least not the kind of like grand romantic gestures that films like Rye Lane, a recent Next Picture Show pick, associate with true romance. Keith, would you like to give listeners a rundown on what we'll be discussing in this pairing?
Sure thing. Celine Song's feature directorial debut, Past Lives, follows two young Korean people through three different phases of their lives, with different barriers separating them in all three acts. Nora, played by Greta Lee, and Hae-sung, played by Tae Yoo, grow up together as friends in South Korea, but they're separated in childhood when Nora's family immigrates to Canada. They reconnect via lengthy online chats in their 20s, but neither of them feels like they're at a time in their lives where they can travel to meet in person. And then they meet in their 30s. Both feel like they may have missed a window for romance, especially since Nora is already married to a man she loves. That particular shape of adult love triangle, and the particular ways it's expressed, remind us a lot of John Carney's Once, a low-key Irish arthouse hit starring musical partners Glenn Hansard and Marketa Erglova as a duo who meet on the street and feel an obvious attraction that they can't act on, in part because she's already married with a child.
The connections between these movies run deeper as Nora works to establish herself as a writer, while the stars of Once are working to establish themselves as musicians. Both films explore issues of longing, timing, immigration, and what it means to say no to romance. We'll kick off the conversation this week with the street-level music of Once, and we'll be back next week with the more cosmic mished connection of Past Lives. Stay tuned.
This song for?
She's gone.
She's dead?
No, she's not dead. She's gone.
My father used to play in the orchestra back at home.
You don't want to go for a walk or something, huh?
To go now.
Stay the night.
Whenever you watch a movie where one or more lead characters don't actually get names, you know a conscious statement is being made. Maybe it's that they're met as such relatable or iconic figures that they don't need the specificity of identification, because they're stand-ins for anyone, including you. Maybe they have an iconic title instead, like The Bride in Kill Bill, or maybe obfuscating and exploring an identity is the point, like in Fight Club. Maybe there are just much more important things going on in the story, like in 12 Angry Men. In John Carney's Once, though, it feels like the leads never get names because they just don't need them. For much of the movie, they explore a relationship that feels so personal, it's as if everyone else falls away. They aren't alone in a place where they don't know anyone else, like Jesse and Celine in Before Sunrise, or literally alone in the world, like the characters in Bokeh, or I Think We're Alone Now. They both have friends and family members who shape their lives and their days. They both have jobs, hobbies, ambitions, and past relationships. And yet they never speak each other's names, because once they're past that first awkward street meeting, names seem unimportant. They're both a little too raw and pared down for identity. They're both focused on each other and the dodges and deferrals that define their connection. Identified only as guy and girl, the leads are played by musicians Glenn Hansard and Marketa Arglova, who met and started performing together when Arglova was 13 years old. Hansard was a touring musician with his band The Frames, and Arglova's father was promoting his music in the Czech Republic, which led to her performing locally with the band. Hansard and her father became friends, and when Hansard's former Frames bassist turned filmmaker, John Carney, was looking for a female lead and musical collaborator for Once, Hansard suggested Arglova, who was 17 at the time. The movie follows these two characters as they meet in the streets of Dublin. Guy, an Irish native, works in his father's small shop, fixing vacuums, and he busks in his spare time. Girl, a Czech immigrant, cleans houses, sells flowers in the street, and does other odd jobs. They hit it off, with Guy first reluctant over the way she calmly pushes herself into his life and demands things from him, then eventually smitten with her. But while Girl seems to share his feelings, she has an entire life she feels obligated to, including a husband back home and a toddler and mother in Ireland who she's supporting. She holds Guy at a bit of a distance, but that becomes harder and harder as they start to sing, compose, and eventually record together. Once was developed over the course of a few years, with the songs written for the musical, and then the film itself shot over a few breakneck weeks, without film permits, which left Carney filming his characters from a distance with telephoto lenses in order to hide the cameras from onlookers and give the actors more space to play out their scenes. Arglova had never acted before. Hansard had a single minor role in the movie The Commitments. Letting the film play out naturally between them, with some scenes and lines improvised, and with Carney capturing actual crowd responses to Hansard's street busking, was part of what gave Once its flavor. So is the established chemistry between Arglova and Hansard as singers and musicians who know each other's rhythms, a must for the movie's many musical performance scenes. But the story's focus on love versus obligation and the distance between the characters caught audiences' attention as much as the memorable music. The movie was the definition of an art house hit, made for around $150,000 and bringing in more than $20 million in theatrical release, then going on to win a Best Song Oscar for the lead single Falling Slowly. Once was adapted as a stage musical, which spent years on Broadway and swept the Tony Awards in its opening year. Part of that success comes from the way the film's bittersweet ending lingers in people's imaginations. Guy and girl part ways, with him pursuing a musical career and her pursuing reconciliation with her husband. The movie never once suggests that she might be able to do both, or chase her own musical dreams, if she has musical dreams of her own at all. But while that might feel like an awkward oversight in another movie, specifically one where the characters are a little more realized and a little less iconic, a little more fixed in time and place, and a little less broad and archetypal, in Once it feels less like an imbalance between the characters, and more like an illustration of two different paths for a working musician. They both have real identities, and they do have a real romance. Once invites the audience to root for them to get together, while also understanding why they can't. But Carney also invites viewers to relate to these two primarily through their music, which expresses things they don't always say in words about what exactly they're missing in life or aching for, including in each other. Music is such a universal invitation that Once's nameless leads end up feeling more like dimly glimpsed implied characters from these yearning, lonely romantic songs than like the messily specific characters they could be. In spite of the movie's title, nothing here really feels like it happened only once in a single place and time. The characters' fleeting connection, their longing, and the way they move on feels like things that are meant to happen over and over again in our minds whenever we go back and listen to these songs.
What's the Czech for ocean?
Ocean.
Ocean.
Pretty much the same.
Ocean. So what are you going to do?
I don't know. There's such distance between me and him. He's so much different to me and so much older. It doesn't really work. I'm fine on my own, you know? It's just, I don't want Ivana to grow up without a father.
What's the check for, do you love him?
Milyeshko?
Milyeshko. So, Milyeshko?
Milyutebe.
So this is a pretty low budge film. I talk in the keynote a little bit about how it was filmed guerrilla style, kind of before really high def digital cameras could do this kind of like long distance low light thing. The whole movie is a little fuzzy, a little low def, at least by today's standards. But making it this way was just very much part of the process that got us kind of the performances and the shape that we got. What do you all make of kind of the filmmaking in Once, just in terms of how it's shot, how it's put together?
I mean, it's not pretty per se, but I feel like it's a case of form fitting content. You know, I actually kind of think it's kind of perfect for this. And, you know, it is in some ways they're making a demos of these songs. It's almost like a demo version of a film. And it kind of works that way.
Wow, that is not a comparison I would have made, but that is extremely funny, honestly. Just the idea of making a demo film for the Broadway play, really.
Yeah,
I guess in some way. Yeah.
I was enjoying on this rewatch paying attention to the people in the street scenes, knowing that it was filmed guerrilla style, and you know, a lot of the extras didn't necessarily know what was happening. And the scene where girl is walking out of the store after buying batteries for the CD player, there's like a bunch of young girls like outside and they're like following her and like as she's singing, and it feels like they don't know that a movie's happening. They probably didn't, but it just like added a really fun kind of layer. Maybe took me out of it a little bit, but you know, I don't think it's a problem, and it's fun, especially on rewatch, to catch those kind of little moments.
And that moment feels a little unreal anyway.
Yeah, it actually feels like a music video the way it's shot and with the long tracking shot.
I think the thing that's really interesting about these kinds of movies that were shot during this time period, the other movie I think of is 28 Days Later, that was also shot on a digital camera. This is like when digital cameras were really starting to come into their own. To be fair, I believe 28 Days Later was shot on a different camera. I think it was shot on a Canon, and this was shot on a Sony camera. So it's not the same camera or anything, but I think they're similar in terms of their aesthetics. Is having movies shot on these specific types of digital cameras really dates the movie and sets it at a very specific point in time? Because it's so weird. For most of the history of cinema, you have, you know, you're shooting on film, right? Then you have like the burgeoning of these digital cameras that have a very specific aesthetic. They look like old YouTube videos is what I would describe them, right?
And then it almost feels like watching something shot on videotape years ago, you know?
And then after, you know, now you can you go down the street, buy a camera for like $800 that, you know, almost looks as good as something you could shoot on film, you know, many years ago. So there's basically like a tiny slice of time when, you know, it was very obvious and you could easily identify digital cameras as shooting on like what kind of digital camera was shooting a film. And so the effect for me is just like basically associating this movie with just this specific kind of 5-year period of time. And it's kind of like preserving that time period for us.
Yeah, preserving specifically the transition from the expensiveness of film to a point where you could make a movie for $150,000 again, as opposed to the previous times you could make a movie for $150,000.
Right. And it would look amazing. You know, it would look like extremely high quality, as opposed to this, which is a little bit more dated, I think.
There's also that one really interesting scene where he's watching home movies of him and his ex, I think on a computer screen. I don't know. It's hard to tell, but it's like there's like another layer of even more like slightly older video with it within this.
It's like a montage that happens during one of the songs, and you're seeing guy's ex, and it's like an even kind of crappier movie. So it's like, oh, there's this film's version of home movies within this film. Yeah.
Right.
I wondered about that sequence because I could have believed that it was shot on videotape deliberately to give it that fuzz, but I just as easily could have believed that those were actual home movies of someone. I don't know who we're seeing there or sort of what the relevance is, but so much of this movie is just on the other side of people kind of being themselves and having their relationships in a movie. You know, so much of it is improvised and ad-libbed and just like pretty close to the working relationship between Glenn and Marquetta. It would not surprise me if those were like revisited home movies from somebody involved in the film. Like, I don't remember a whole lot very specific there, although I think there is at least one shot of her with Glenn.
The ex-girlfriend is played by Marcella Plunkett, who doesn't have a lot of credits, but her next credit after, well, no, she's a couple of things, but Sing Street, she's also in Sing Street. Mm-hmm. So there is definitely seems like a Carney associate of some kind.
It's all friends and friends of friends in this film. Like that party scene too, that's just all his friends and his mom sings at one point. Very, very sweet.
I thought that was a nice sequence, although I would like just a tiny bit more context when that comes up. It's so, as I kind of talked about in the keynote, like they have friends and jobs and hobbies and families and lives. But at the same time, something like that is just really out of the blue when you go from these two people exploring this very tender, very specific relationship to let's walk into a giant room full of people who will never be introduced, who we don't even know whose friends they are at first. And like nobody greets them in a very personal way. And then you come to find out this is probably something that Guy does on the regular. That's just sort of a collection of people who get together and sing. But the details are all very fuzzy. And it just seems like such a fascinating social scene. I'd love to know just like a tiny bit more about it.
It kind of feels to me like a sort of mirror of the scene when when Guy comes to a girl's apartment and meets her mom and her daughter and the three dudes who come over to watch TV. It's just like each of them kind of being in each other's lives and spaces and being a bit of an outsider because, you know, girls in that scene too, she's just like kind of in the background watching him, you know? So I think it's sort of serves as an underlining of the fact that they do have, you know, lives separate from the other person, like not everything else in their life drops away the second they meet. And that's one of the big complications of this movie.
Let me just put this out there, which is that I don't know how many of present company are musicians, but I'm a musician, and there is a lot of kind of paradoxical dynamics at play, I think, when you are a musician making music with other people. Because on the one hand, it can be one of the most rewarding, thrilling experiences one has ever participated in. And on the other hand, it's also incredibly transient. You know, it can be extremely transient. Certainly, it's economically precarious, as is demonstrated in this movie. And so it's not like, oh, hey, this is a thing we can do consistently and make tons of money from. Like, and so sometimes these people float in and out of your lives. And that's, you know, that's very much kind of the core theme of the whole movie between these two characters as well. So to me, the whether or not we're introduced to the other musicians didn't really bother me that much. It felt like it captured kind of some of this real life dynamic of, hey, we're making something that is extremely beautiful. And probably I'm going to talk to you five other times the rest of my life. Now, that's not always true. Sometimes you become extremely close friends and those friendships can last a lifetime. But that's not always the case. So I felt like this, you know, that was one of the more true to life elements of this film is it captures how intimate and tender that connection can be and also how fleeting it can be.
I love that you pointed that out, and it makes me want to turn to what I think is the scene of the movie, which is them playing Falling Slowly in the music store together and kind of this moment of connection when they just can play together, you know? And I mean, I don't play music at level even close to that. Like, I've never experienced that feeling of playing with someone else, with being able to instantly harmonize with someone else. But it's magical to watch. Like, that moment feels more romantic than anything else in the movie to me. And it, like, the romance of this film is so much more about the music than the two individuals in the romance.
Absolutely. But also consider how precarious that moment is in the sense mm-hmm. that like all the things that had to like line up for that moment to happen. Right. Like she just happens to meet him that one night and she just happens to have this connection at this music store with this guy that just happens to be OK with her plan. You know, like if any step along that chain doesn't happen, like they never make music together and the movie doesn't happen, you know, so it feels like it's as powerful as you say, but it's also like it was very close to not happening, you know.
It reminds me a little of the most recent A Star Is Born, which we covered on this show, just in terms of like that moment when Lady Gaga like walks out on stage and joins in on the song. There's been no rehearsal. She's just like jumping in and supposedly ad-libbing, but it feels like a very polished performance. And it does feel magical. I mean, I think in any movie, there's maybe a little bit of the fantasy of if you have somebody who's an expert at something and they meet somebody else who's on the same level at them, whether it's like two assassins recognizing each other in the middle of a fight and having one of those like game recognizes game moment or something like this where you're playing music together. I think there's always just that when you see that moment of recognition in a film, it's always a little special. At the same time, David, I'm curious as a musician, like I know that people, particularly in the jazz scene, can kind of sit down and say like we're doing this in this key on this beat and just sort of start improvising together. But I am wondering how this plays for you in terms of hear the lyrics, the song goes da 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 da, just go with it. And then the next thing you know, they're playing this beautiful duet.
I'd say it's mostly plausible. You know, like I kind of am very, you know, when I see those scenes, I'm always curious, like, is this actually something that they could actually pull off? And I thought it was pretty plausible the way it plays out in the movie. It's not like unreasonable. It's not like Glee, you know, like the TV show where, you know, sure. They come together and it's like perfect the first time. I think it's like, you know, the songs are kind of basic enough and the direction clear enough that I think it could happen. That's my perspective anyway. So.
But could that band have followed Marty McFly when he just says, watch before the changes? I mean, would that actually have worked?
No, I have no comment on that, Keith. I have no comment on that.
I want to go back to, we talked a little bit about the sequence where Guy sort of fantasizes about, remembers, watches videos of his old girlfriend. One of the things that maybe strikes me most in this movie on a rewatch, my first rewatch since it came out, and I think I watched it a couple of times that year because I was so taken with it, and particularly with the music. Watching it, coming back to it again after all this time, like I maybe notice more the imbalance between them in terms of how they're presented and how the story is told. And one of the big things there is we see guys like sitting down with these memories of his old girlfriend after a girl has rejected him sexually. But we don't see the husband that she's rejecting him for until the very end of the movie. We end up with a lot more insight, I think, into his feelings and his life than hers, in part because we're listening to more songs that, within the confines of the movie at least, he has written about his relationship and his past. And there are songs that she's written, and we have a very emotional moment around one of them, but it's less emphasized. So I'm curious what you all make of kind of like that mode of storytelling in terms of kind of putting his experience first in a lot of ways.
I mean, it puts her a little bit in a manic pixie dream girl role, does it not? Because I mean, like, he's so defined by this heartbreak, like not just his songs, but just his entire way of being. And it seems like that is maybe as much of a driver of his attraction to girl as the music. Like he seems to be in a very raw emotional place and kind of hungry for a connection that she gives him. So like I'm tipping my hand here a little in terms of like the romance, but like I don't necessarily think this is a lost romance for the ages. I think it's sort of a romance of context and circumstance. And I think his heartbreak is a big part of that context.
I would agree. I think I agree with that. And it's a great point, Tasha, that it does feel like the movie is largely through his perspective, mostly his songs. And I don't even think we get Marquetta, you know, girl's husband's face at the end of the movie. Like, I think
it's like a long shot of him holding the kid. Yeah.
He's holding the kid, but I don't even think we see his face. So, so I think there's a
little glimpse of it, but we certainly know, we don't find out what his name is. Like, we don't spend any time with him. We don't hear him talk. That said, there's something like normally I might feel like this was a case of he's more real than she is. But I kind of like the idea that this man isn't real until the end, and that it's just kind of a coming into focus of her and her life for all of us. Like, I feel like a lot of the movie, we do seem to sort of be filtering through his perceptions and what he wants, and sometimes his frustration at how damn pushy she is. But at the end, when we finally see the husband, to me at least, it just kind of feels like, oh, he's not just an imaginary barrier to you getting what you want. Like, he's a real person in a real space that she actually has a real relationship with. And I don't know, there's something about that I like, in terms of almost shifting the perspective to like guys kind of going off into the fantasy land of maybe this musical thing will work, but she's kind of like coming home to something real.
I think that works too. And I think in a way it's appropriate that he doesn't get very much screen time, because he is, you know, the equivalent player to the ex-girlfriend who we hear on the phone but never really see except in those home movies. So, you know, these are characters that are deeply important to our main characters, but they're also very much on the margins of the story itself in some ways.
Well, related to that, Tasha, sorry, I don't know if you're planning to bring this up later, but like, what do you make of the fact that, or maybe you already covered it in the earlier comments, but what do you make of the fact that they don't have names, right? Like, for me, my interpretation of the fact that they don't have names is not, oh, these are like just archetypes of what a man and a woman in this kind of romance is. Like, that's not my interpretation. It's like, it's more like the whole thing feels very incidental, you know, like the whole story feels very incidental. And so the idea that we don't get any detailed understanding of who this ex-girlfriend is, who this husband is, feels like it's a feature, not a bug, or what's intended, you know?
Yeah, I dug into this a bit in the keynote, yeah, which I wrote and recorded separately from the rest of this podcast. But my take on it was basically that there are a lot of reasons to not give characters names. But in this case, I honestly feel like these characters feel almost more like characters out of song than characters out of film. And maybe mm-hmm. it's just because this is such a music forward story.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, if you name like any like rock or pop or singer-songwriter ballad or just, you know, song in general that you love, that's iconic, very few of them are a Living on a Prayer kind of story where you get introduced to the characters at the beginning and told what their names are. There's often just a lot of, for some reason, I'm thinking of somebody that you used to know. You know, these characters don't have names, but you can instantly identify them and their feelings. You know what their relationship used to be like and what it is now. You know what the singer wants, but the characters within that song don't need names. And that's just kind of the feeling I get here, is these two people are pretty iconic. They're also specific in a lot of ways, but you can see them as just like not universal figures, but song figures.
Yeah, I think that's a great point.
Yeah, I totally agree with that interpretation. But I think maybe like another layer of it is that it adds to the intimacy of this film. Because like when you're actually like talking in conversation with people you know and love and talk to a lot, like you don't say their name very often. Like I probably say my husband's name aloud like once every couple days, you know? So there is something about like removing that exposition element of like saying a character's name for the sake of saying it. It just adds, like I said, to that intimacy.
At the same time, saying someone's name has a kind of intimacy. I would call it the fact that David does it pretty frequently in his podcasting. I mean, he's called me by name, I think, more than once now already in this podcast, which is just kind of a quirk.
He's a very good broadcaster and we're not.
It's a quirk that I have often noticed about your podcasting, David, because it's not a very common thing, but it's something that I really enjoy. It does seem like it adds like an intimacy. Like I think here on this podcast, we tend to have just sort of a very general, it's almost like every thought is just sort of being thrown out on the table and whoever wants can pick it up. But you have a way of directing things to people that just feels a little more intimate and a little more pointed and specific. And I like it. But that said, using somebody's name is kind of a form of direction and intimacy. And we don't get it in this film. We get this kind of just like free floating two people who talk to each other a lot, but don't ever address each other exactly.
It is fun to see how the movie gets around that. So I think the guy refers to girl often as herself. At the end of the movie, he goes to her house and the babysitter, the nanny's there, and he says, "Is herself in?" And I just thought that was a fun way of getting around the fact that neither of them have names in the context.
Yeah, it is sort of funny that Guy is a perfectly acceptable male name and girl really is not an acceptable female name. So yeah. Whenever we talk about, oh, Guy does this, it sounds fine. And whenever we talk about girl does this, it sounds really odd.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you make of the music in this film, like in terms of just the songs? I feel like... one of the reasons I'm so predisposed to like this is that I really like both this style of music and Glenn Hansard's music in particular. Going back to the Frames days, I just really enjoy his performance and the verve he puts into singing. But I could very easily see there just being a whole section of people who watch this movie don't really like the songs or the style of music here. And the whole movie is just like an annoying like buzz of unwanted sound because it's so dependent on the songs.
I think you're right. I think you do have to really like the songs in the context of the movie, which I do. For the movie to work, you can't be at odds with its music. But I never really listened to this outside the context of the film. I think it's terrific inside of it, but it's never really drawn to the 12 season apart, you know, when I'm not watching once.
Oh, gosh. I got a little obsessed with them. I dug up all of their music. I have seen Hansard in concert multiple times. He came through the AV Club for an AV Undercover. Not hugely long. Now I'm not sure if it was before or after, but I want to say it was after this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes, it would have had to be.
But he's really intense in concert in a very delightful and affable sort of way. But, you know, when he's singing some of these songs and he just goes like full on screaming on the streets, like that's his performance style.
I mean, I kind of like Keith said, I like his performance style. I like it in the context of this movie. It's not something I have really pursued much outside of this movie, you know, and I think that's fine. It's just like not my favorite type of music. It's also not like buzzing noise or whatever you said. Like, I don't dislike it. You know, I don't think it's particularly difficult music. I also don't think it's particularly like hooky music, with the exception of maybe Falling Slowly. You know, like the songs all work really well in context, you know, lyrically, performance wise. But if I had to hum any of them right now, other than Falling Slowly, yeah, I don't think I could. And that's fine.
When your mind's made up doesn't stick with you, given that that line is repeated about 1,000 times, sometimes at high volume.
I mean, okay, if you told me hum, if your mind's made up, I could, the song that happens at this point in the movie that I just watched a few hours ago, yes, I probably could. Yeah. But I can't say for sure much longer than that.
David, what's your feeling on this style of music?
Well, first of all, I feel the need to point out, in case you're not already aware, I believe the Swell Season is touring this summer.
Yeah.
So
I was going to bring that up, too. Yeah. I looked it up there. The Chicago show is sold out, I'm afraid.
Right, right. But other shows are not. So if you're a fan of the Swell Season, they are performing to celebrate the 15th anniversary of Once, although I think it's actually been 16 years since Once has come out, so yeah. I'm a little confused by that. But
they also released a new song earlier this week.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I think you get a bonus. You get a little wiggle room because of the pandemic. You know.
There you go.
Anniversaries get a little mushy.
Yeah. So I haven't actually shared my overall thoughts on this movie yet, but I think it's perfectly fine and nice, you know, like, and the reason I don't think it's particularly more than that is because it is, as you said, Tasha, so heavily dependent on the music. We're not only hearing multiple songs full length, but sometimes I believe the same song full length, mm-hmm. I believe there's like a couple songs that are repeated all the way through. So if you don't like this music, I think it is very difficult to enjoy the movie. And my opinion on the music is it's fine. It's fine. It's pleasant. Do you know what I'm saying? And as a result, that kind of mirrors my feelings on the film. Is that like, yeah, because it's so heavily dependent on I don't find it objectionable, nor am I like, wow, this is extremely powerful and I love it. And I feel like the movie wants me to feel that way, the latter, you know, in order for it to work at the maximum emotional level. And sadly, I don't think it gets there for me. It's fine. I like it. It's perfectly fine. That's kind of how I feel about it, you know?
I think that's fine. I'm not entirely sure that this movie does want you to be like full-throated passionate for these two to get together. You know, I don't think that Guy entirely knows what he wants. I think he's in a place of transition. And as he says, he's lonely. You know, he hits on her because he's lonely. And he at the beginning in particular, when she's just like a stranger importuning him on the streets to fix her vacuum cleaner, he seems to tolerate her because it would be impolite to do otherwise. And as the two of them kind of move closer to each other, she's pretty adamant and specific about like, no, we can't get together. And that's not something that I'm interested in. And he pushes her anyway.
I don't think the movie wants you to feel like they should get together or anything. But I feel like when they're performing for the first time together or when they're performing in the recording booth, like I think we as the audience are meant to feel like this is one of the film's emotional heights. Right. Like, you know, it's like the shallow scene in Star is Born, which for me, that did, you know, that song is awesome, in my opinion. You know, like that did work its magic on me. So I don't think it's like they want you to think it's some torrid love affair. But I think that because these songs, I think, are supposed to represent the emotional high of the movie, because these people are spilling their guts out. Right. This is their way of communicating their deepest feelings. If the music doesn't work for you, it's hard for you to get to where the movie wants you to get. But I don't think it's like related to them getting together or not. Just want to clarify that.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's entirely fair.
I think the movie also kind of nudges you in that respect through the character of the recording engineer, who is very sort of dubious and disengaged at the beginning, and but is won over by the power of their music, and you know, becomes part of their little magical weekend recording crew. You know,
absolutely. Yeah.
If you don't relate to that guy, yeah, maybe it doesn't work its magic on you.
I think that's true, but I do think that it's significant that he's won over from "I'm bored and these are a bunch of weirdos" to "yeah, that was pretty nice." I mean, he doesn't like greet them as they come out with "oh my god, you're all going to be stars and I was there." Like, he's not blown away by their performance. He's just like, "yeah, that was pretty nice." Pretty much what David just said.
Yeah, that's, and which is kind of like my reaction to the movie. Like, there's some people who are, I think, more rapturous on this film, but it's that guy's journey. He's not like, "that's a number one record" or anything like that. You know, he's like, "that's pretty nice."
Or he's not the loan officer just dying to give them a small loan and also play his song for them.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. In the stage musical, which I read just like a point by point breakdown of, apparently he gets to perform with them.
Oh, nice.
Because you don't have somebody in a musical like that. Apparently he is presented as not really great in the stage musical, but he does get a song to himself and then he gets to go on and perform with them, which I find hilarious.
Can I just say, I wish we had more of those moments in the movie. Like, the opening scene I thought was amazing when the guy tries to steal his money from the guitar case. and then they bump into these people, you know, the guy, the loan officer who secretly wants to be a musician. And, you know, they kind of encounter this group of people singing in this dining hall, you know, all these like lovely naturalistic moments I really enjoyed. And I thought, based on the opening scene, that was the movie we were going to watch. But instead, I think, you know, a fifth of the movie's runtime is just songs and montages.
You mean,
you know,
something like more verite, like shot on the streets of Dublin kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Which I really, that stuff really resonated with me, you know, and I wish there was more of it.
I do find the progression of that first scene pretty hilarious.
It's amazing, yeah.
Somebody is eyeing my money to the chase, to the revelation that they know each other, and he sees this guy all the time and calls him by name. Like, that's just, it's a really well stretched out comic bit.
Agreed.
Another scene kind of in that vein, but that also bridges the music side of the film, is them on the bus and him telling her in song about him getting cheated on and kind of strumming a little on his guitar. And I love the woman on the bus, like kind of laughing at the whole thing.
But also turning around to give them a bit of a librarian, like, you're in public, young man.
But then she laughed afterwards. She thought it was funny. So that scene.
Was she an extra or was she just someone riding the bus?
I would love to know.
Yeah, I certainly assume the latter, but who knows? I love that moment because there is a lot of people expressing themselves, expressing things that they don't say through music in this movie. But that in particular is just like a great big deferral of emotion. They both do it at various points, but this is both the silliest version of it, and it's maybe a catchier version of it. Because it's not freighted with huge emotion. You know, it's not a falling slowly. It's not an if you want me. It's just here's this very silly little ditty where I downplay this relationship that broke my life. I'm a tattered shell of a man right now, but I'm going to put it in the goofiest, bounciest pop terms possible. I think that song is very funny, but I also think it's really telling that he apparently did write this song. Like I don't think he's improvising in that moment. He's just got this little play ditty that he's put together at some point of bitterness in his life. And he whips it out rather than just answering the question.
Agreed. It's a great moment.
It feels like the only way you can talk about it too. I mean, and especially someone you just met, but maybe at all. This is definitely a character who expresses himself best through music, and perhaps really only through music.
And I think part of the connection between guy and girl here is, and also maybe one of the things that makes her more of a manic pixie dream girl than she'd be otherwise, because she doesn't fit the stereotype in a lot of ways, is she recognizes immediately that the song that he's singing on the street was written for a girl who broke his heart. Mm-hmm. Like she just goes straight to who was she? And I think that while he doesn't initially want a relationship with anybody he just met on the street, like he really wants to kind of push her away and go back to singing. But I think her observation that just she immediately knows that he's expressing something personal, and then she starts asking him very nosy questions about it, I think kind of hooks into his loneliness a little bit.
The only other thing I want to add is one thing I really appreciated about the movie is just how it ends, which is these are by the end, I think these are fairly mature people, and the relationship kind of they need to go their separate ways. And there's this a very casual, I think, not casual, but like there's an acceptance of it on both parties that I think it's just nice. You know, like not every movie needs to end, or not every relationship needs to end super dramatically, or big speeches need to be had. In fact, like there's not even really a big goodbye for the two of them, because they miss each other. And so that's something I appreciated that added to the naturalism of the film for me.
There is a grand gesture, though, in the form of the piano he buys her. And I would like to know how he afforded that piano.
Yeah, I want to get weighed down with that kind of stuff. That was kind of getting to me, too.
There is a grand gesture, but there's no kind of reaction to the grand gesture. You know, like, I mean, you see her smile and accept it, but like they don't talk about it or anything. You know, that's just the movie. Yeah. And so I appreciate how understated it was, basically.
Honestly, we'll get into this when we pair this up with Past Lives, but that is the number one thing that made me relate this movie to Past Lives is the adultness of we're not really going to go forward with this relationship, and the fact that it doesn't break either of them. They both kind of accept it in a mature way that seems unusual for a romantic film.
I really like this last scene they have together where she uses the phrase hanky-panky. And it's not even, you know, it's not clear that this is an English phrase that she understands at first, but then you kind of get the sense, yeah, no, she knows what she's saying. And I don't know, like there's a few mysteries in this movie, and I don't know if she, when she says she's going to come by later, if she ever planned to, if she decided not to later, if that was like, if she recognized that as kind of a Rubicon moment where she could either get back together with her husband or engage in hanky-panky. and I don't know, I like that it leaves that unanswered.
Another line that's part of that exchange is like they're saying like that would be nice, it would be very interesting, and then she goes, but worthless though, like the yeah. the idea that, you know, whatever hookup they did, like it couldn't mean anything, you know, there's really no point to it in their present circumstances. I like the idea of it being worthless.
So one of the things that fascinates me in this movie is that both of these characters push each other a lot. Like she goes through that whole nagging thing where she wants him to teach her how to ride the motorcycle. And he's like, no, this isn't mine. And you'll damage it. And it would be very upsetting to my father. But then they just kind of circle around that idea in that moment. And then they don't do a Gilligan cut to him showing her how to ride the bike or her crashing the bike or anything like that. It's just the pushing and the pushing and the pushing. And when they're sitting in the studio with a piano and he says, like, play one of your songs. She says, no. And he says, do it. And then they go back and forth and back and forth. There are several moments like this with the vacuum cleaner. No, you're going to fix my vacuum cleaner now. I'm going to come to lunch with you now. There's just a lot of pushiness on both of their parts, but not around sex. He asks her to stay. She says no. He apologizes and then doesn't bring the idea of a relationship up again until late in the film when he throws it out and she gently deflects it with humor and he kind of agrees with her humorously and then they move on. Those are the two moments in the film where he tries to push for more. She says no in two different ways. And then he just doesn't push it. But so many other like encounters between them. The whole motorcycle thing made me kind of uncomfortable. I was just like, take no, lady.
Wow, that's really interesting that you interpret it that way, because I just see it as flirtation. Like, I just see it it's a scene that really highlights the age differential between both these characters and these actors, which is, you know, we don't need to get into that. It's a little squicky in my opinion. But like, I feel like it's just kind of her being immature and taunting him, and you know, he's taking it to a certain degree because he is infatuated with her somewhat, but I don't necessarily see it as like, it's maybe a little bratty, but I don't really see any sort of annoyance on either of their parts in those interactions. But
oof.
Yeah,
that one in particular, it seemed to me like he was outright uncomfortable, because he does want to give her what she wants. He does want to, you know, to bring fun things into her life, but he's caught between her and his father, and the fact that he stole this motorcycle from his father, who wouldn't approve. And he gets tenser and tenser throughout that scene, and it's not cute for me.
Yeah, I just don't think, I didn't find it that serious, I have to say. But yeah.
All right, David, Keith, you're in charge of breaking the lock here.
Yeah, I was kind of more with Genevieve on this one, sorry.
Same. Sorry, Tasha.
She's just being a cute little brat.
Yeah, if I don't have everybody disagreeing with me at least once per podcast, it's not the next picture show.
No, so no, this is Tasha, this keep pushing good. Your opinion on us. Tell us why we're wrong.
No, because then I might make you uncomfortable, and like, you probably borrowed this podcast from one of your parents. It's just gonna be real squick. The one other thing I kind of wanted to touch on, though, is one of the movie's romantic gestures is something that the audience may actually not understand until they read about it later. He's asking her, do you love your husband? But because he's uncomfortable with the question, he asks, you know, how do you say this in Czech? And she tells him. So he asks her the question in Czech, like as a way to distance it from himself. And she answers in Czech, no, I love you. And then he doesn't have any idea what she just said, and she never translates it, and the movie never clarifies. That was an improvised moment that Marquetta came up with. Glenn did not speak any Czech and didn't know what she'd said, and he's reacting in the moment like as the character, but he also does not know what that moment means as you see it happen on film. So I'm curious just what you make of that in terms of like a storytelling beat that you kind of have to be all Scott Tobias about it, like go to an extra textual place to even understand what just happened.
I wonder if they knew. I mean, I wonder how much the thinking that people are going to figure this out later on the internet, if that played into the thinking at all.
Maybe. It's such a big thing to have happen like without anyone knowing about it. I like, it's a great story, you know, that it was totally improvised, but like, I feel like it has to have been acknowledged and the decision made to leave it in. But yeah, it's wild to me, especially that like such a young actor would throw a line in like that. Like, it's a major shift in their relationship. Or maybe not. Maybe it's like I don't know Czech. Maybe there's different types of words for different types of love. Maybe she's expressing a platonic love. I don't know.
It's the same word, whatever it is, because I pulled out a translate program and I looked it up online because I was curious about the same thing. And whatever she gives him as the question he asks about her husband, it's the same word in both cases. So if it's no, I platonically love you, she also was just asked if she platonically likes her husband.
Let me come in here with a contrarian take here, both on the movie Once, which I think a lot of people love and will be upset to hear my lukewarm feelings for in general. But also, let me get on to team It's Not That Big of a Deal. And what I mean by that is we already knew these characters shared like a deep connection, and it's not as though when she says like I love you, it doesn't come like, if they had subtitled it, it wouldn't be like completely out of nowhere. Like, I think we know that they have some affection for each other, and the strength of the movie is that despite that, like, they realize that, hey, this is not a thing that we can act on. We have our own lives, you know, we have plans of our own, and we need to move on. So I had already kind of come to this from the place of they already have a deep connection that is at times goes into the romantic. And so for her to just say it in a way that he doesn't understand, it's like, it confirms what we already believe, but like, it's not like it obviously doesn't change the outcome. So team, it's not that big of a deal.
No, I actually like that you say that. And I think that's a better encapsulation of what I was trying to get across than platonic, or like distinguishing different types of love. Cause like, you can love different people at once and at different times in your life and in different circumstances, and they are going through like a very intense connection moment, you know. So I don't think her saying I love you is her saying I want to run away and be with you forever in that moment.
Oh, for sure. I mean, if she was committing in any way, she'd say it in a language that he understands or would translate it. She's deferring the same way he's deferring his emotions. She's hiding behind knowing that he doesn't understand. And she's almost teasing him with it.
Yeah, I'll push back a little bit against team It's Not That Big a Deal, because I think the no is very significant there. Like, no, I love you. It's a denial of her husband. And I think, you know, I think ultimately this is a lovely, bittersweet ending to this, but you have to at least be invested enough in the spark between them to think maybe if things had gone a little differently, maybe as like what David said, if things had lined up just slightly differently, they could have been a couple. They could have, like, you know, acted on this. They could have found out what they're going to spend the rest of their lives wondering about.
Well, as it happens, that's the big theme of the other movie that we're going to discuss in the second half of this discussion, that question of how things fall together differently in a different life. So I think we're going to call it on Once and just go sing in the street for a little bit, maybe talk to each other in languages that not everybody here speaks, and we'll be back with a little bit of feedback. It's time for feedback. But before we get to it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Campanar and Josh Larson. As we're recording this, Adam and Josh's most recent episodes discuss the movie that we're talking about next week, Past Lives. They also discuss Pixar's Elemental and the top five movie characters who shaped them, with Pop Culture Happy Hour's Aisha Harris in celebration of her new book, Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. As for feedback, Bryce in Toronto recently wrote in with some thoughts about our pairing on Synecdoche, New York, and Asteroid City, specifically about the Wes Anderson film's Opacity. Genevieve, will you read this one for us?
Sure. Bryce writes, "No surprise, there are moments of truly exquisite beauty in this movie. Meticulous art direction, production design that makes your eyes water. Quirky, whimsical, often funny, and the total realization of a director's aesthetic vision. And while I don't always agree with Tasha, it seems to me that since Grand Budapest, there's been an ironic detachment to the performances in Anderson's film that have metastasized to the point where I'm not sure he can find room for genuine emotions anymore. The stiff formalism of Budapest seemed to be a goodbye to any kind of sentimentality, and maybe to our ability to truly feel something for what's happening on screen. The relationship between Gustav and Zero still had tender, authentic moments of loyalty and fealty, which gave the film a quiet heart, but I'm not sure that's happened since, and in this film, I'm not sure he's even trying. To be fair, ScarJo is sublime. Even through the stoic mask Anderson seems to insist all his actors wear in this movie, you still feel the pathos swirling around inside her character. The meaning of it all, however, remains hidden, perhaps by design."
David, I'm going to throw to you on this one, since you weren't here for that discussion. Wes Anderson's Asteroid City, completely emotionless, opaque movie with extremely unclear meaning? Or do you have like a map to the stars that you can share us?
I don't think the meaning is unclear. You know, I think it's very much a story about both, you know, I think grief is a huge part of the story and like what it means to move past certain stages in your life. And to a large degree, it's also a story about creating art and what it means to create art when you the artist don't even necessarily understand the full context and meaning of what you've created. I think those are very powerful ideas in the movie. Wasn't a movie that I connected with very much personally. I think it is pretty inaccessible. I think the emotional distance that the movie holds you at really kept me away from it. But it's clearly something that's intentional. You know, my co-host on the Filmcast podcast, Jeff Cannata, compared it to the work of Bertolt Brecht. It's very Brechtian, and there's this intentionality of removing any kind of recognizable emotion to it. And for a lot of people, I think that's working well. And just for me, it didn't work quite as well. So I love the ideas, but just didn't connect with the movie emotionally myself.
I didn't either when I was watching it, and I felt that was intentional. The more I've sat with the movie since we recorded about it, the more it's coming into focus for me as a film, not just about creating art, but just creating in general. I kind of feel like that's one of the things that links the whole frame story of a radio or TV show. It's kind of unclear to me that's showing us a play, that's showing us a story, with the young scientists who are creating these inventions. The movie is very humorous about in an extremely straight-faced kind of way. They're all people who want attention. You know, the boy that jumps off the roof, the boy that's constantly daring everybody to dare him to do things, kind of comes out and says, like, he's just looking for attention. And I think kind of the tension between the people in this show who are creating art for attention or for plaudits and the people who seem to be living it. Or things like Jason Schwartzman's character coming to Ed Norton's character and just kind of like donning this character and method acting him at the playwright, and then seeking what seems to be a sexual connection. Like, there are different ways and levels at which people create things, and for very different reasons and with very different intentions. And I think there's just a lot going on here in terms of different ideas about why people create. Even the three little kids with their like creating rituals around their dead mother and inventing like a whole kind of mythology around her are building something creative in order to explain the world to themselves. I feel like this is a movie that you maybe want to see a couple of times to scratch below just a very glossy and resistant surface. I think that this movie is going to play better on subsequent views, and I certainly don't blame anybody that doesn't connect with it, but it's finally beginning to kind of sink in for me as a movie with thought through resonant themes instead of a movie about nothing, which is certainly an accusation I've seen aimed at it.
Yeah, it's not fair. I've seen it twice now. And like, you know, I talked about it on the show, but the key scene to me is the moment where Schwartzman's steps, you know, character steps out of character and goes and talks to Margot Robbie on the balcony. And like, that really got me the first time, and boy, did it get me the second time around. I really think, yeah, it is a movie that benefits from a second viewing. And I don't know, there's sort of this knee jerk, you know, rejection. I don't think that's what Bryce is doing when he's writing in, but there's a knee jerk rejection of Wes Anderson, the whole Wes Anderson thing in some quarters. And I think he's a superb filmmaker, and I look forward to whatever he does.
I found out today, kind of by accident, that like I was just Googling the movie for some specific thing, I think probably to look for images to tweet out our episode about it. And ratings from people who've reviewed it on Google specifically are averaging about 2 stars out of 5.
Is it all five and ones though? I mean, is it like all like 5-star reviews and 1-star reviews?
It's mostly ones and twos. Mm. It's averaging out like much, much less high and low bell curve than I would expect, and much more are the twos are just kind of pulling it up from just being like 1.5. I think it's interesting because, like, the same Google page that showed me that also showed me that, like, Rotten Tomatoes users are averaging about 7 out of 10. IMDb users averaging about 7 out of 10. But people who reviewed on Google really don't like it. And I don't know what that says about that demographic specifically. But I find it interesting that it's so different.
I have wondered how the recent-ish TikTokification of Wes Anderson is maybe coloring some people's reactions and or just sort of maybe enabling that knee-jerkness that you mentioned, Keith. Like,
I don't know what these words mean, TikTokification. And
I don't
want to know.
Oh, Keith.
I'll just say I don't think that anything that's happening on TikTok with regards to people imitating Wes Anderson is leading to them like disliking this movie more than they otherwise would. I think there are a couple phenomena that might be at work. Number one, in my opinion, having seen every single one of Wes Anderson's films, this is his least accessible film. Like, in my opinion, other people may disagree. So
this is weirdest film. That's for sure.
Weirdest film. Like,
the comedy has a certain immediate appeal to it that maybe isn't always there in his movies. Even if you're not necessarily follow, you know, even if the movie is a little baffling, I think there's some really broad comedic stuff and some fun characters to latch onto. But yeah, it's by several degrees his strangest film.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe most or at least accessible may be unfair. Maybe it's one of the. How about that? But so that's part of it. And the other part of it is, if anything, the movie's doing quite well at the box office, from what I understand. And maybe there's a lot of people who are seeing a Wes Anderson movie that otherwise wouldn't have seen it. Or maybe they expect Wes Anderson to be merely an aesthetic and they see the movie and they find out that there's kind of deeper layers than what's there, and they react differently. So maybe there's an outside possibility it's having a negative impact, but I don't know that it's not like I'm sick of seeing the TikToks and therefore my opinion of the movie is bad. It's kind of maybe the TikTok set a different expectation than what people are.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at.
Apologies,
so thank
if
you
I misunderstood.
No. I thank you for saying it more concisely than I did.
Yeah, I guess I do wonder if so many people doing him on such a surface level kind of like devalues what he actually does a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I do have a hard time imagining people watching six Here's My Day as a Wes Anderson character TikToks and then thinking, I'm going to go see Asteroid City. Well, that wasn't like TikTok at all. I have a very hard time imagining it working that way.
I think it's possible. I think it's possible.
But, I mean, TikTok has changed how music is made and written, you know, like it has an effect on all media eventually.
And David, before we transition out of this, because this is most definitely a rabbit hole and one that we could spend the rest of the night going down, do you see, like, because you're on so many different mediums and you're creating content in so many different formats for so many different platforms, do people on TikTok relate to you about movies or just creation in completely different ways from some of the other platforms you're on?
I will just say, I think that the thing that I've been most impressed with on TikTok is just the sheer amount of creativity that is available. A lot of Gen Z people making extremely, I would say, effective short films on TikTok. One recent trend that is a lot of fun, if you want to look it up, is the Grimace Shake. I don't know if you've heard of this.
We did a whole thing about it, but actually, as with so many TikTok things that trend, you can find it on YouTube, where I'm a little more native because I don't have to download
Instagram,
the app.
Which is where I get all my TikToks.
Right, sure.
Like the elder, the millennial I am.
I'm watching these Grimace Shake videos on TikTok, and I just like I'm like, I don't even know how some of these were. There's like visual effects in some of them. I'm like, I don't even know how some of these were achieved. So I'm constantly kind of impressed at the creativity of the folks on there. I don't know that the way they relate to film is any different. The way they present their thoughts is quite different than people who have listened to this point in this podcast that we are on right now. But I think the creativity and the inspiration is definitely there. So.
Well, I look forward to seeing what TikTok and every other medium that seems to be taking up the Wes Anderson flag does going forward with Wes Anderson. But I'm also looking forward to seeing how Wes Anderson himself develops, because Asteroid City does feel like just an ongoing development and specification of his style. He's just becoming more and more Wes Anderson with every movie. I'm very interested in.
What if he just goes to TikTok? What if he likes, I'm going to beat them at their own game. I'm TikTok Wes Anderson now.
I might re-download TikTok and get back on if I could just check in with Wes Anderson's daily exploration of some bizarre set or the other. I
don't know if you saw he commented on the trend too. He said, please don't send me videos of people doing me, is what he said. because he didn't want to be self-conscious. Because when people, quote unquote, do you, then you ask yourself, is that what people think of me? You know?
So, is that what it sound like? Is that what I look like? Exactly. Now?
It's a wonder that Christopher Walken can still act.
Absolutely. Or Nicolas Cage. Nicolas Cage book.
Yeah, even going back to the Cannes Film Festival, I watched the news out of Cannes very closely because when the film premiered, the only thing I was expecting out of interviews was everybody asking him, what do you think of the AI versions of you at the time? And like he's pretty much consistently said, like, I've never watched any of this and I don't want to know about it. He's kind of like Keith talking about what TikTok is. I just don't want to know.
Good for him. Good for him. That's what I said.
Well, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations, as long as they're not trying to tell Keith what TikTok is. If you feel so inclined to talk about anything else, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. That's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll talk about Past Lives, a film that puts its genteel love triangle a little more on screen and then offers a metaphysical explanation for it all. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Twitter at nextpicturepod if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, though, remember, if you show up at a sing-along party, you'd better be prepared to sing.